Today is Tuesday, December 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, South Africa begins a week of mourning for Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who died at the age of 90.
The bells of St. George's Cathedral rang out for 10 minutes on Monday. It was here that Archbishop Tutu gave refuge to many during the dark days of apartheid.
President Biden offers help to governors in the fight against the Omicron variant of the coronavirus.
The president delivered a message in a virtual meeting with the governors.
If you need something, say something, and we're going to have your back.
And the U.S. and Iran have resumed talks on salvaging the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Indirect talks between Iran and the United States on salvaging the 2015 Iran nuclear deal resumed on Monday, with Tehran focused on one side of the original bargain, lifting sanctions against it despite scant progress on reining in its atomic activities. The seventh round of talks, the first under Iran's new hardline president, Ebrahim Raisi, ended 10 days ago after adding some new Iranian demands to a working text. Western powers say progress was slow and negotiators had, quote, weeks, not months, unquote, left before the 2015 deal becomes meaningless. Little remains of that deal, which lifted sanctions against Tehran in exchange for restrictions on its atomic activities. Then-President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of it in 2018, reimposing U.S. sanctions. Iran later breached many of the deal's nuclear restrictions and kept pushing well beyond them. Tehran refuses to meet directly with the U.S. officials, meaning that other parties must shuttle between the two sides. The United States has repeatedly expressed frustration at this format, saying it slows down the process, and Western officials still suspect Iran is simply playing for time. The 2015 deal extended the time Iran would need to obtain enough fossil material for a nuclear bomb, if it chooses to, at least a year from around 2 to 3 months. Most experts say that time is now less than before the deal, though Iran says it only wants to master nuclear technology for civilian uses. South Africa has started a week of mourning for Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who died Sunday at the age of 90. Cape Town's St. George's Cathedral will toll its bells every day at noon through Friday in honor of the anti-apartheid hero before a Saturday funeral service. Vicky Stock reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
The bells of St. George's Cathedral rang out for 10 minutes on Monday. It was here that Archbishop Tutu gave refuge to many during the dark days of apartheid. His non-violent campaign won him international recognition, including the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. He was also greatly loved by his countrymen and women. Veteran journalist Aisha Ismail explains.
You know, as a South African and as a journalist, when I think about Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I think about love, I think about justice, I think about peace, and I think about compassion. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was the one who opened the doors of this cathedral when we were fighting the apartheid regime during the height of apartheid and during the state of emergency. We were tear gassed, we were shamboxed, and it was the Archbishop who opened these doors for us to come and seek refuge. He will be deeply missed, and I think I can safely say that South Africa has lost its moral compass.
Once democracy was established in South Africa in 1994, Tutu continued to campaign for human rights, championing all kinds of causes around the world. In recent years, he also spoke out against the African National Congress, which is in power in South Africa. He was outraged by the unchecked corruption within the party. Children and young people were close to his heart. He was a patron of many trusts. The CEO of one of them, Jason Falcon, says even when Tutu was ill, the Archbishop was in email contact with him so they could work out a plan to ensure funding came in after he passed on.
Not only for the trust, but also for our beneficiaries, the children of Tigerberg Hospital, has been immense. You know, the arch and my layer, the many visits to the hospital was always filled with joy and laughter. The kids really looked out for that. But over and above that, the arch was also very instrumental, especially in the early years of the trust, in raising significant funds, specifically for the purchase of much-needed medical equipment, which ranged into the hundreds of thousands of rands.
The assistant priest at St. George's Cathedral, Marcus Slingers, says it was a great privilege to have visited Tutu at his home in Milnerton, a Cape Town suburb, for about 40 minutes each day.
We are all saddened by this great loss. The Dean and I and others, you know, in this last few months, had the opportunity of celebrating the Eucharist with him every day. And that was part of his life. And I've just been privileged, you know, to have been part of it. And what a man of God and humble.
The Archbishop's 66-year marriage to Leah Tutu was admired by many. They had four children, Trevor, Tandeka, Naomi and Mpo. Father Marcus says on his visits to Tutu, Mrs. Tutu would tell him stories over cups of tea about how they supported each other.
And how the two of them had just done, you know, things together. Everything that they've done together. And our hearts and our prayers, our thoughts are with her and the rest of the family.
A number of events are planned for this week, including a memorial service which the South African Council of Churches will host on Wednesday. Archbishop Tutu's body will lie in state at St. George's Cathedral on Friday. His funeral will take place there on Saturday. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town.
Surging coronavirus cases across the world are threatening healthcare systems in countries seeing a significant spread. The newest variant, Omicron, led to thousands of flight cancellations ahead of the Christmas holiday. U.S. President Joe Biden last week announced plans to send 1,000 service members to support U.S. hospital staff and plans to stockpile masks and gowns. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
More than 700 inbound, outbound, and domestic commercial flights in the United States are canceled. Sunday's news comes after airlines say they grounded thousands of flights leading up to Christmas, with reports of pilots and staff falling ill amid the surging Omicron variant of the coronavirus. But at some airports, like the one in Newark, New Jersey, it's business as usual. Health experts warn that anyone in an airport will likely come in contact with the Omicron variant. But recent reports from South Africa and England point to promising data showing surging Omicron infections as being less likely to lead to hospitalization or severe illness. Sunday on ABC's This Week, President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said that does not signal the all clear.
When you have such a high volume of new infections, it might override a real diminution in severity. So that if you have many, many, many more people with a less level of severity, that might kind of neutralize the positive effect.
Fauci praised the president's multifaceted plan to have military personnel in support roles at U.S. hospitals to help deal with surging cases, along with ramped up testing and stockpiling personal protective equipment. Still, he says, vaccination remains the single best way to prevent disease.
We're particularly worried about those who are in that unvaccinated class, that, you know, tens and tens of millions of Americans who are eligible for vaccination who have not been vaccinated. Those are the most vulnerable ones when you have a virus that is extraordinarily effective in getting to people and infecting them the way Omicron is.
Despite the looming threat of Omicron and all the canceled flights, the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport was packed with holiday travelers last Friday, Christmas Eve. Omicron now accounts for nearly three-quarters of all U.S. cases. According to news reports, the average number of new infections is about 165,000 per day. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
President Biden is telling the nation's governors the government is ready to help in the fight against the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. Associated Press reporter Ed Donahue has the story.
President Biden is telling the nation's governors the government is ready to help in the fight against the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The president delivered a message in a virtual meeting with the governors.
If you need something, say something. And we're going to have your back in any way we can.
One need the president is aware of is testing.
Seeing how tough it was for some folks to get a test this weekend shows that we have more work to do, and we're doing it.
For the vaccinated, President Biden says the variant should be a source of concern, but not a panic. It's a different story for the unvaccinated. He says this is much different than in 2020 at the start of the pandemic.
We're prepared, and we know what it takes to save lives, protect people, and keep schools and businesses open. We just have to stay focused and continue to work together.
The administration plans to make 500 million rapid tests available beginning next month through an as-yet-to-be-developed website. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The White House says it's lifting travel restrictions to 8 Southern African countries. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The restrictions were imposed last month in hopes of slowing the spread of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 after South African health officials first identified it there. The move barred nearly all non-U.S. citizens who had recently been in South Africa or in nearby countries, including Botswana, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, Mozambique, and Malawi. The White House says the temporary travel bans bought scientists necessary time to study Omicron and conclude that current vaccinations are effective in blunting its impact. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has recommended they be lifted on New Year's Eve. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The United States is one of several Western democracies that independent right groups say has seen an erosion of democratic institutions in recent years. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane spoke with democracy experts about what they say is causing a slide in global democratic freedoms and how to reverse it.
The world was shocked when supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to prevent Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's election victory. The scenes of mayhem inside the symbol of American democracy had a powerful negative impact, experts say, at a time when numerous studies show democracy in decline around the world. A study by the Pew Research Center shows that only 17% of people in surveyed countries said U.S. democracy is worth emulating. That compares to 57% who believe it used to be a good example. Deep divisions over race and the role of government have existed in the U.S. ever since its founding. While polarization remains, views of the U.S. internationally did improve dramatically when Joe Biden was elected to succeed Donald Trump, according to Pew's Richard White.
People liked Biden better than Trump. They liked his policies better than Trump. They liked to see the United States engage with the rest of the world. They like a more multilateralist approach to foreign policy from the United States. So when Biden did things like rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, rejoining the WHO, you know, those kind of policies were embraced by people in other nations.
Democracy experts say the U.S. needs to look at the root causes of people's grievances if they want to reverse the global decline in democracy. Experts say efforts to defend democracy at home and abroad will continue to be a priority and a challenge for President Biden and his administration in 2022 and beyond. Cindy Sane, VOA News, Washington.
For those people without resources or family, the holidays can be incredibly difficult and lonely. A group of Russian-speaking retirees in Los Angeles decided to do something to help some people feel less alone. Angelina Bagatsian has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Cheer and optimism. That's what retired Russian-speaking residents of Los Angeles wanted their gifts to provide homeless people with.
Bright colors give people warmth. Orange and yellow, light blue. I hope they feel a little warmer. They will feel people around them care. Maybe their life will change.
For this exhibition held in a homeless shelter in Los Angeles, California, local retirees have created dozens of paintings. Each one has a message from its author. Pearl Miranda, who has lived on the streets for many years, says she deciphered the message.
This art just pretty much reminded me that there's hope out there. You know, we can pretty much look forward to something better. It makes you feel like there's no darkness out there, you know? It's a bright life out there.
Oftentimes people have been traumatically impacted in their life when they come to the mission, and sometimes art therapy is the only modality that will really help them recover and heal in areas that normal therapy sometimes doesn't address.
Retired Los Angeles resident Ludmila Briditskaya painted this picture. She's been creating art for years. She says art therapy helps make life a little brighter for her and others.
They were talking to me and other artists here, and it was great. Well, I was doing my best. My English is bad and my memory is bad. But we understood each other. I wish them all a very Merry Christmas. This is a time for miracles.
I was very happy that I could help a homeless shelter resident a little. It's such a suitable time for that, too. Christmas.
Shelter resident Catherine Jones says the thing she fears the most is loneliness. So she says being surrounded by people is the best holiday gift she could have hoped for.
I was affected by COVID with my job and of the disability. Being alone by yourself as a woman is hard. It's scary. And this, the art today, is really a blessing. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I love it.
A message of hope and joy shared with those who are struggling and alone this holiday season. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, California, NRI's VOA News.
For U.S. social media companies, the violent mob storming the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th last year spurred action. They shut down then-President Donald Trump's accounts. 1 year later, are Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube any better prepared to face similar situations in the U.S. or in any other countries? Michelle Quinn reports.
1 year after supporters of President Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol, the former president is still not permitted to use Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, the digital stages where he directly spoke to millions of followers.
It's not a fair situation. Very, very bad for this country. Very bad for the world. If they can do it to me, they can do it to anyone.
Trump was accused of using the platforms to stoke the riot. His suspension is a stark reminder of the power social media companies have over political leaders who run afoul of their rules. Despite the ban, after January 6th, social media companies came under intense fire from critics who said the suspension was too late, coming years after tolerating Trump's violations of the company's rules. For their part, technology companies have said they're constantly working to make their services safer. Twitter's former CEO said at a congressional hearing that Twitter did bear some responsibility for disseminating disinformation that led to January 6th, but pointed to the larger culture.
But you also have to take into consideration a broader ecosystem. It's not just about the technology platforms we use.
There have been some changes. Twitter enacted a 5-strike policy on misinformation about COVID-19. Facebook now applies its content moderation rules to politicians, a group it had shielded in the past. But the changes strike some experts as small. Looking out to elections this year, the potential remains that social media could lead to more unrest, observers say. Some critics point to the company's way of making money, advertising, and how the firms have created algorithms that highlight extreme content that is more engaging. Whistleblower leaks at Facebook showed how some of these problems are familiar to company executives. In the coming year, lawmakers could try to force the companies to make bigger changes to policing controversial content and being more transparent about what they are doing. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
In other news, a court in military ruled Myanmar has postponed its verdict on 2 charges against ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi, in which she's accused of importing and possessing walkie-talkies without following official procedures. A legal official familiar with the case says the court gave no reasons for delaying the verdicts until January 10th. The case is among many brought against the 76-year-old Nobel Peace Prize laureate since the army seized power in February, ousting her elected government and arresting top members of her party. Suu Kyi's supporters and independent analysts say all the charges against her are politically motivated and an attempt to discredit her and legitimize the military seizure of power. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Tension is rising in Somalia following the suspension of the prime minister by the president over alleged corruption. In the latest fight over who will lead the country amid delayed elections, critics of President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, also known as Farmajo, says he's looking to stay in power by any means necessary, As Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu, Somalia, the two men recently disagreed on the electoral process.
In a press briefing, embattled Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble said he will carry on his constitutional mandate to conduct the electoral process for a peaceful transfer of power. The Prime Minister termed the move by the head of state to relieve him of his duties as an attempted coup. He said the decision by the former President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed Farmajo are a clear attempted coup, violation of the constitution and the laws of the country. The Prime Minister added that, apart from the violation of the country's law, President Farmajo used security agencies to attack the office of the Prime Minister and that of the cabinet to try and halt their national duties. The residents of the capital, like Abdulwahid Hussein, say they are concerned political upheaval could spark violence similar to clashes in April between forces allied to opposition and the government troops that rocked the capital, Mogadishu. He said the difference between the president and the prime minister is very unfortunate because it could lead to violence and create insecurity that will displace people and destroy investment. Omar Yusuf is a political analyst and a lecturer of international relations at the University of Simat. He says the country's leaders need to show restraint amid reports security forces have been deployed around Roble's offices. When the disagreements translate to violence and use of armed forces, it will be a difficult environment to conduct elections, and thus the process could stall again, and once the elections are over, it will pose a significant threat to state-building process in Somalia, which has been recovering for the past 2 decades. He added that, in order to avoid that destruction, both sides must refrain from using security agencies and still start dialogue in holding transparent elections. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu strongly urged Somali leaders to take immediate steps to de-escalate the tensions and refrain from proactive actions. Somalia's parliamentary elections were supposed to conclude before end of the year, but are nowhere near complete, with over just 70 members of parliament out of 329 selected so far by the tribal delegates. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
India confronted serious security and domestic challenges in 2021. They included country's military standoff with China, which showed no signs of easing, a deadly second wave of COVID-19 that devastated the country, and the biggest farmers' protests in decades that challenged authority of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
The most serious confrontation between India and China in decades ended in February when they withdrew troops from a disputed border stretch in Ladakh. But the India-China frontier remains a dangerous flashpoint as talks to resolve differences at other contested points in the Himalayas have hit a stalemate. India, which had long focused on rival Pakistan, is now preparing to meet the security challenge from its much bigger neighbor. It is building roads and tunnels to move troops and weapons faster along the China border. Prime Minister Narendra Modi participated in 2 summit meetings this year with the United States, Japan and Australia to firm up a strategic grouping called the Quad, meant to counter China.
That's a challenge that India has woken up in ways that are quite dramatic. But I think that was happening even before the present crisis happened. And now, of course, India is responding in kind. We have seen India not only ratcheting up its troop presence along the border, but also taking some important decisions like formalizing Quad.
Domestic crises also challenged Modi. A deadly second wave of the coronavirus pandemic, fueled by the Delta variant, sickened or killed millions in the summer, just months after Modi had virtually declared victory against the virus. His government floundered to cope. Thousands of farmers who camped on roads around New Delhi to lead a year-long protest against market-friendly reforms won a huge victory when Modi scrapped the laws. It was a rare concession by a leader who has seldom tolerated a challenge to his authority from his secular rule. The Xi in on India's strongest leader in decades has worn off, say analysts, especially as millions of poor people deal with the economic devastation caused by the pandemic. Coping with a more assertive China and addressing economic distress will continue to challenge India. Anjana Basricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Some Muslim clerics in Iraq's Kurdistan region are calling on religious leaders to take a more active role in countering radical ideologies. The call came during a conference of clerics gathered in the Gamayan district in Iraq's Kurdistan to discuss ways to counter radicalization. VOA's Dilad Anwar was at the conference and filed this report narrated by Rikia Hussein.
About 70 Muslim leaders in Iraqi Kurdistan's Gamayan district met Tuesday to discuss how to combat radicalization. They argued that religious leaders should be more active in combating radical ideologies.
As far as Islam is concerned, we feel there's an effort to distort its pure and correct path, which is in line with human nature. We've noticed this effort and are holding this important conference to discuss ways to counter radical ideologies.
Leaders from several schools of Islam attended the meeting, ranging from those who follow mystical Sufism to those who believe in a more fundamental approach, such as Salafism.
We need to stress the peaceful coexistence between religions and different ideologies. We want to deliver to the public the message that the holy religion of Islam supports the peaceful coexistence of all different beliefs and religions.
The conference took place as Islamic State extremists ramped up their attacks on Kurdish villages and security forces. In separate attacks this month, militants killed at least 25 Kurdish civilians and Peshmerga soldiers. For Dilshad Anwar in Gamayan, Kurdistan region, Rakar Hussein, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Juno is NASA's orbiting mission to Jupiter and its moons. The space agency's Juno team presented the probe's latest findings at the recent American Geophysical Union's fall meeting. Among the highlights offered included the sounds of the Jovian moon Ganymede from data that was gathered as Juno made a close flyby in June 2021. The data that generated these sounds was collected by the spacecraft's WAVES instrument, which is used to monitor electric and magnetic radio waves that are generated within Jupiter's magnetosphere. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that Juno was within 1,038 kilometers of Ganymede's surface during the close flyby and was traveling at a relative velocity of 67,000 kilometers per hour. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series. Education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa News. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
voice of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.